Thank you. Simon Gertler on behalf of the Lapista Band of the Agueño Mission Indians. And with me in the room now holding my laptop is my co-counsel, Michelle Lapina. I intend to reserve 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The tribe has suffered irreparable harm to its cultural resources and religious practices from the unlawful construction of a 30-foot tall border wall and related infrastructure through its traditional territory.
Mr. Gertler, let me ask you some questions. I know we asked you or sent out a notice that we might be inquiring about irreparable harm. It seems to me there were a number of factual disputes in the record before the district court as to the harm suffered by the Lapista tribe. And I guess my question for you is, why was the district court required, because that's how you argue, was required to conclude that Lapista had made a sufficient showing of irreparable harm?
Your Honor, because the evidence in the record, it satisfies the likelihood of irreparable harm standard. And there's one important point that I want to start with, that the government didn't rebut the tribe's evidence on one really important point. And I'll explain that here. The tribe's declarations through traditional knowledge and archaeological evidence attest to the likelihood of burial sites within the project area. And the district court suggested that many questions exist as to the likelihood of that assertion. But the government relied on findings from the district court relied on findings from the government surveys, from its field surveys. And I looked back through the record preparing for today's hearing, and the government doesn't allege either implicitly or explicitly anywhere in its declarations that it didn't find burial sites in its surveys. In other words, the government offered no evidence whatsoever to rebut the tribe's evidence of burial sites in the project area. So the district court made an inference that was not based on facts in the record.
Counsel, maybe I misunderstood the record, but I thought there were two specific findings that you urged the court to make regarding potential human remains. One where the government says, no, there was just a piece of PVC pipe, and the other one was apparently south of the border in Mexico, and DHS obviously couldn't go over to investigate that. Was there additional evidence that I didn't see of burial?
Yes, Your Honor. Those two findings were discoveries made during construction. But the tribe's declarants, the tribal chairwoman, a councilwoman, the tribe's in-house archaeologists and outside archaeologists all offered evidence based on their own traditional knowledge of the oral history of the tribe, and also Richard Carrico, based on evidence from other archaeological sites in the area, that there is a high likelihood of burials in the project area.
Well, high likelihood, but the question is, have they actually discovered any? Isn't that the issue? Otherwise, we're hypothesizing here.
Well, the test here, the standard, is a likelihood of irreparable injury. And I think the archaeological evidence demonstrates there's a high likelihood of burial sites throughout the project area. And the construction will inevitably destroy some of those sites. And I'll get to this later. I don't think the government's mitigation measures adequately address that harm.
But the district court found that was a contested issue of fact that it would need to hold an evidentiary hearing on. Isn't that correct?
Right, and that's where I think the district court erred, because the district court, again, pointed to the government survey results. And the quote that it cited in the record was Paul Enriquez from Border Patrol, when he said, Border Patrol surveys and record searches do not indicate the presence of any known burial sites or historic villages. Now, the first time I read that, I didn't catch that, but the key word there is known. He says, did not indicate the presence of any known burial sites. And he says that again on the following page of the record that I'm looking at, 152, paragraph 50.
But we're still speculating, are we not? I think that was a concern that Judge Battaglia had. I mean, you can say there's a possibility because there are no known sites that have been found, but I guess the question I'm asking you is that enough to overturn the district court's concern that you just didn't have enough evidence that there actually were ancestral village sites or burial sites inside the construction zone.
It may have been enough if the district court said the tribe's evidence on its own is insufficient, but I think what the district court really looked to here was that there was counterpoints on the government side. And the point that I'm trying to make is actually there weren't counterpoints on the government side. I think if the government had served, the government surveyed the area, and if from its surveys it didn't find any evidence of burial sites whatsoever, it would have said that in its declaration, but it said something different. It said there were no known burial sites. And we knew that already based on the records review that our own archaeologists did, and that's in the record, that there were no prior surveys here. So there wouldn't have been any known or recorded burial sites found through a record search. The point of the
government... I thought there was a survey done in 2000, a resurvey done in 2020.
Yes, yeah, so the resurvey was done after the records review, right? The point of the records review was to find the existing cultural resource surveys and their results. The new survey was to survey unsurveyed areas and find unknown archaeological previously unknown archaeological resources. So the government did their surveys in unsurveyed areas, and what they don't say, and I think what's significant here is what they don't say, they didn't say they didn't find any evidence of burials. They said we didn't find any evidence of known burials. And that's
maybe this is a tautological argument, but how do you prove the negative? If they haven't found anything to date, then why should we assume that they will find something in the future?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not asking the government to prove the negative here. They did a field survey of the area, and they concluded they didn't find evidence of known burials. They could have said, and this is not proving a negative, they could have said, we did a survey and we didn't find any evidence of burial sites, so we think the tribe's wrong here. What I'm suggesting is that they did find evidence of burial sites and they didn't put that in the record.
Well, how can you square that with their statement that there are no known sites? That's why I'm saying it's sort of a tautological problem here, and you really are asking the government to prove the negative when you can't prove the positive.
Let me move to my next point here, because I do think there's some significance in the word known here, but the government does acknowledge that it found other isolated archaeological resources, and so the government essentially concedes, yes, there are some cultural resources in the project area. Maybe it doesn't acknowledge there are burials, but those
were these resources that would not have been sufficient to meet the requirement for registry on historical places?
That's what the government suggests, but I don't think that's the threshold for irreparable harm. That's a standard under NHPA, but we're talking about irreparable harm here, and the tribe has stated in its declarations that all of the cultural resources in the project area are important to the tribe, and harm to them will be irreparable. And I'd like to compare this to the standard that this court has made in other cases, like the Alliance for Wild Rockies case, which was the same posture as this case here. The Court of Appeals reversed the district court on the irreparable harm issue, reversed the denial of an injunction on the irreparable harm issue when it said that a logging project was going to harm the plaintiff's members' ability to view, experience, and utilize the national forest. It cited their interest in hunting, fishing, hiking, horseback riding, cross-country skiing. Here, the tribes asserted an interest in its cultural resources. The government has conceded there are resources in the project area, and I think that's enough under this court's precedent to demonstrate irreparable harm and an abuse.
But don't you think there's a big difference between activities that are occurring in the national forest and activities that are occurring along the international border, which we know from our own docket produces many, many cases of illegal alien and contraband smuggling?
Well, I mean,
it seems to me that's a very different factual scenario if we're balancing equities, is it not?
Well, this court didn't say so in the Sierra Club cases. It heard the government's arguments on that point and still held in favor of the Sierra Club that it was experiencing irreparable harm, in that case to its recreational and aesthetic interests in the international border area. And to Your Honor's point about contraband coming across the border, the Sierra Club, in the Sierra Club 2 case, this court also recognized that the government didn't actually have evidence of contraband in the project area, that the contraband was apprehended at ports of entry. And the evidence in the Sierra Club...
Well, counsel, if you're going to try and convince us that there's no contraband being smuggled across these open areas of the border, you're wasting valuable time here. I've had innumerable cases that did not have anything to do with designated border crossings, as have my colleagues. So I don't understand your point here. I mean, Mr. maybe Gerber, you're saying it's not... Go ahead,
Judge. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to... I thought you were done. Can you point me, to the best evidence that you supplied or La Posta supplied that would support a finding of irreparable harm similar to that in Sierra Club? What are you drawing on in terms of the evidence for your allegations in the complaint that would make this more comparable to Sierra Club in terms of the harm?
There are a number of places in the record. I'll cite to one, and then I'd like to save my time for rebuttal. But this is a statement from the tribe's chairwoman, Chairwoman Parada, and she says, the project area along the proposed border wall structures is home to significant Kumeyaay spiritual and cultural sites, reflecting our deep and abiding tie to the area and the sensitivity of the project site. Sorry, this is at page 286 of the record. And then she notes that these sites will be impacted further by additional construction and without protection or care. I'd like to save the remaining time.
Well, just a minute. Let me ask just one question. I don't know if that responds to Judge Bernier's question, but, you know, I'm going to pass that by. Answer this question. Can you point to me a specific finding that the district judge made on the irreparable harm issue that you're attacking, say, whatever the standard of review is for, you know, for lack of evidentiary support or whatever it is, that finding was erroneous. First of all, tell me what finding it is.
Well, the only...
Do you understand my question?
I think I do. Okay. I think I do, Your Honor. The only finding the district court made on irreparable harm was about the presence of burial sites in the project area. And it said that was unlikely considering the survey results of the government. As I explained in the beginning of my argument, I think that was an error. But additionally, the district court didn't consider many of the other claims of irreparable harm that the tribe has made here, the sort of broader environmental harm claims that this court recognized in Sierra Club. And another, an important one there, I think, is the trails that the tribe talks about, these sacred trail systems. And the only response the government made there was that 14 miles of the project are existing wall and won't cut off those trails. Well, we've got 4 additional miles that will, and that's what the tribe's concerned about. So I'd like to say,
but we're talking 14 out of 21 miles, are we not? That's already either walled or has vehicular barriers that are being replaced.
Yes, Your Honor, that's right. And this court recognized in League of Wilderness Defenders versus Connaughton, and this court looked to that case when the government made the same argument in Sierra Club, that where there's harm to some part of the, in some part of the project area, it's irrelevant whether there isn't harm in another part. You know, the focus is on the irreparability of the harm, not the severity or the magnitude.
But I think the finding, if I understand Judge Tashima's question, is found at the bottom of page 35 and the top of page 36 of the district court's order, where he specifically references that the likelihood of injury is first mitigated by the efforts of the defendants with regard to these protocols, consultation, cultural monitors. And then he recites the fact that it should be noted that much of the activity will occur on federal land, which has already been disturbed with barrier wall construction. Isn't that a finding by the district court?
Yes, and I have responses to both of those findings, why they're erroneous and illogical and abuse of discretion, but I see my time has expired.
Go ahead.
Okay, so with regard to, I think the first thing you mentioned was mitigation. And with regard to mitigation, the district court cited the Border Patrol's cultural resources plan, which it noted was in draft form and being finalized. And we're 6 months into project construction now, and certainly over 50% complete. And a draft protocol is not very comforting to the tribe at this point. But even if it were final, the goal of the plan is repatriation of cultural resources after they're disinterred, after they're taken out of the ground by construction. And the injury occurs at the time they're taken out of the ground. So the fact that they're repatriated is something that the tribe would like to happen after the injury, but it doesn't change the irreparable harm there. In with regard to your other point about the area being previously disturbed, again, it's disturbed in certain areas, like where there's existing fence, but that doesn't change the fact that there are still burials in other areas or even in areas that are already disturbed. And the project here is excavating a very large trench, an 8 foot deep by 2 foot wide trench for this 30 foot high wall, which is a disturbance that this area hasn't seen before. And that's really the disturbance that the tribe's concerned about.
Can I ask you a question on a slightly different subject? Because I'm curious, in La Posta's view, are the ultra-virus and APA causes of action distinct? If the ultra-virus cause of action is effectively foreclosed by the language of the Supreme Court's first stay order in Sierra Club, would that mean that the APA claim is also foreclosed? Can you comment on that, please?
Yes, I don't think so, Your Honor, because the Sierra Club case didn't raise the APA claim. The APA claim was in the California versus Trump case, which didn't receive a stay from the Supreme Court. So I think anything the Supreme Court said in its stay doesn't affect the tribe's APA claim, which is controlled by this court's precedent in Sierra Club in California versus Trump.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I'll give you time for rebuttal. You're our only case this afternoon, so I feel a little liberal in giving you the amount of time you need to give you that opportunity to rebut. So, Ms. Murphy?
May it please the court, it's Anne Murphy for the government. Your Honours, the district court did not abuse its discretion here. It concluded that La Posta had failed to carry its burden on any of the elements necessary to support a favorable exercise of discretion from the district court. It concluded correctly that La Posta failed to show a likelihood of success on the merits, and it properly considered all of the relevant factors there. It correctly concluded that La Posta had failed to show a likelihood of irreparable harm, particularly given...
Ms. Murphy, let's talk about irreparable harm here, if we can start with that. And my question, why isn't the sort of recreational and aesthetic harm that was established sufficiently, I guess, to determine harm to be irreparable harm in Sierra Club sufficient here?
Partly because it hasn't been alleged from the beginning of the case. This is a fairly new development. And in fact, if you look at the complaint at pages 17 to 18 at La Posta's complaint, it's very clear that the actual focus of the case, and they mentioned this also in the hearing, is the burials. This is also the first time I have ever heard La Posta argue that the injury occurs when the burial is actually unearthed. Again, if you look at the complaint and if you look at what happened in the district court, their argument has always been that remedial measures are sufficient, provided that appropriate cultural measures are taken. And I would just like to point out to this court that there is no evidence anywhere in the record of this case of the government ever doing anything culturally insensitive to a known cultural resource. even the ones where there's some question about whether the thing is in fact like a cultural resource or just a piece of PVC piping. The government has always allowed tribal members to address that in their own way and do what's respectful. The government, as you know, has tried to involve the tribe from the outset. And so one of the reasons that the court
About Mr. Gertler's, argument that the government survey wasn't very thorough, or it seems like he was talking about the survey by the government, and it does appear that the government survey wasn't very thorough, and the government did find some archaeological resources, but didn't explain what those were.
I'd just like to point out, this is a preliminary injunction, so all the district court has is literally, I mean, the government hasn't even answered. All there is the complaint and the attachment. So to some extent, the court just had to work with what it had. The government's had a presence in this area since 1907, and there are numerous surveys and archaeological surveys. The government made all of its, the government, you know, has an archaeological contractor on site to make sure that no problems. It made all of the archaeological contractors' materials available to the tribe. And when the tribe wanted to suggest that there were additional areas of sensitivity, then the government resurveyed those areas with tribal cultural monitors present. So to the extent that an area hasn't been closely surveyed, the government has certainly been listening to the tribe in terms of what other surveys are needed. The other thing, Your Honor, is that there are surveys, and what Mr. Gertler said was that we hadn't, and this is true, that there are no known burials. So I'm not quite sure how we are supposed to identify unknown burials. The truth is that the government has looked for them, the government has surveyed for them, the government has enrolled the tribe to help with these resurveys, and none has been found. It's not even a contested fact issue, Your Honor, because the tribe acknowledges that there's nothing, that no burial has been found in the area. Similarly, for the villages, Your Honor, there are known historical archaeological sites. None of those are in the construction area. The other thing that the evidence shows that's significantly important here is that when things are found, then the project was changed. The design of the project was changed. There were two archaeological sites found, and a road was rerouted to avoid one of them. And for another one, a well was put in a different place. So the evidence before the court overwhelmingly was that the government is making really extraordinary efforts to make sure that none of the harm that La Posa is worried about actually happens. I think the court found that very important. Significantly, Your Honor, there's again the question of the bones that may not have been bones. In each instance, the key thing is not kind of the factual dispute about where it was or what happened, but for purposes of making sure that harm is avoided, the key thing is that in each case, the tribal members who were present were allowed to go ahead and deal with the issue as appropriate to them. Even though on one occasion it involved crossing the border and crossing back into the United States, not at a point of entry. So again, that's the government really making an extraordinary effort to make sure that none of these harms would come to fruition that La Posta had identified. So as I mentioned, Joanne, the allegation has never been that the harm involves actually disinterring. It's always been treating the whatever is found respectfully. The other thing with respect to that, Your Honor, the other part of the government's avoidance strategy is that the protocol, it's, you know, still currently being finalized, but it's in place and the government has undertaken to abide by it. And that protocol provides that if anything is found that's culturally significant to the tribe, work will be stopped, the tribe will be contacted, and it will be given time to deal appropriately with whatever is found there. and there are tribal cultural monitors on site who can go wherever they want and observe whatever they want. So I think what the district court found here was given, you know, the nature of the harms that were alleged in that court, and the government's evidence of really taking extraordinary steps to work with the tribe as much as possible and to avoid any possible harms, that that really foreclosed it, the judge's ability to grant a preliminary injunction here.
Can we talk a little bit about the likelihood of success on the merits? It seems like the district court here recognized that the Sierra Club 1 injunction was based on the ultra-virus cause of action, and that the state order wasn't necessarily relevant to the APA cause of action. So even assuming we're persuaded that the earlier stay order foreclosed LaPosta's ultra-virus cause of action, I guess I'm just trying to figure out what authority permits the district court to interpret the stay order as also foreclosing the APA cause of action.
All right, that's kind of a complicated question, Your Honor. If you don't mind, I'm going to bite at it in two ways, so please bring me back on track if I don't answer it appropriately. First of all, I don't think it's fair to say that it was just the Supreme Court stay order that, that made the district court conclude as it did on the likelihood of success on the merits, and that that was not a ground for granting relief. Like, it was also looking to orders that this court had issued. The other thing is that the Sierra Club stay is a complicated animal because it first came to this court on a preliminary injunction where it was just Sierra Club's injunction. But by the time it got to the Supreme Court, it was a permanent injunction, which although Sierra Club, there wasn't an injunction for California, but California and the other states did file in the Supreme Court. They filed an amicus brief. So the arguments of the state were at least present there, even if you're not looking as the stay as kind of binding authority. I don't think that the district court suggested in any way that the stay would be binding authority. It was just reading tea leaves. So that from the government's perspective, Your Honor, as you know, we filed a petition for certiorari in the Sierra Club case. This Solicitor General has authorized the filing of a petition for certiorari in the 2808 cases also. Those petitions argue that there's no cause of action for really a very similar reason under the APA and under the ultra-virus cause of action. So from the government's perspective, the arguments are very much the same.
Counsel, are you relying on the language of the July 26, 2019 Supreme Court order where the court said, quote, among the reasons is that the government has made a sufficient showing at this stage that the plaintiffs have no cause of action to obtain review of the acting secretary's compliance with section 8005, end quote?
Yes, we are. And that's certainly what the Supreme Court said. And as the district court said, explained here, when the Supreme Court does tell us what it's doing, it's important to look at it. I think my response was more to do with the idea that the district court treated that as some kind of controlling precedent, which I don't think is true, because the court's just looking at the likelihood of success. I mean, frankly, Your Honor, at this point, none of us, the district court was right. None of us knows, whether that claim is going to be sustained or not. The Supreme Court's now granted certiorari. And so at a bare minimum, all we can say is that we don't know what the answer to that is. And La Posta, of course, has to show that.
We do know from Maryland Chief Justice Roberts in chambers opinion, the three factors that the court considers when it considers lifting a stay or entering one, do we not?
We do. And so Your Honor, and that certainly weighs in favor of the government because the court has to find a fair prospect of reversal and it has to find that there's a likelihood of irreparable harm to the government if the stay is denied. So, yes, I mean, you know, there is every reason to suppose that the government will prevail in the Supreme Court, but I don't want to overstep here and like say more than I ought to. And all the district court, the only showing that we need to make to sustain the district court's decision is that La Pasta has failed to show that it's likely to succeed on the merits of the claim. And that seems to be manifestly correct.
Yeah, I was just struggling a little bit because what the Supreme Court had in front of it when it issued the language that Judge Tallman just referred to was the preliminary injunction regarding, you know, 8005 and whether it was a cause of action. And I just was, there was no APA, you know, claim in that case. And I just don't know if that's just too broad of a reading that the district was giving it. So that's why I asked the question and tried to sort that.
Sorry, as I mentioned, when the court got the case, you know, the cases were consolidated. There was a permanent injunction. California did a filing. And as I say, from the government's perspective, APA, no APA, ultra virus, there's no cause of action for anybody because these statutes simply don't contemplate these kinds of suits. And so, you know, under the zone of interest analysis, APA or no APA, it, you know, doesn't make too much difference, Your Honor.
Now, the other language that I noted and I'm trying to figure out what to do with is in Sierra Club 3. Section 8005 is not an issue, but there the majority basically rejects the government defendants' arguments that the Supreme Court stay of the injunction related to Section 8005 necessarily determined that the harm to the federal government from the injunction prohibiting border barrier construction outweighs the plaintiff's interest. And the majority in that case specifically says we cannot read into the order more than its text supports. And so would we be reading more into that order, into the text supports? Is there a basis for us to disagree with a panel that's already looked at that? And why is this context different, I guess?
So I think part of the answer is in Maryland and King, as Judge Tallman suggested, in order to grant the stay in the Sierra Club 2 case, the Supreme Court had to conclude that there was a likelihood of irreparable harm to the government if the stay was denied. So I take Your Honor's point about what the majority said in the 2808 Sierra Club 3 case. But I also think you don't necessarily have to agree with what the district court did here. And one of the things that, you know, that we see throughout this court's cases is this court, you know, for example, in the 2808 case, what the majority said about the decision in California, it wasn't an abuse of discretion for the district court to deny the stay. It's not that we would have done it the same, but the standard of review is one that provided that the district court acts within the permissible scope of things that it can do, then that's up to the district court.
So the Sierra Club 2, you know, we have a panel majority that looked at now cause of action on the merits and very obviously disagrees with whatever preliminary finding or decision that the Supreme Court had on a cause of action. And I know that there was a motion to lift the stay, and all we have is the Supreme Court saying it was denied, nothing else. And I'm just trying to reconcile that, you know, with our adherence to Miller versus Gandy, which says there has to be a clearly irreconcilable statement by a higher court. So help me navigate how to how to reconcile that.
Yes, so this gets right back to the question about the fact that this is a preliminary injunction appeal. So I understand that if there's like controlling precedent and a district court is applying the law to the facts and it says, here's the Ninth Circuit decision, I just have to follow that. And the Supreme Court may even have taken the case, but it's still the Ninth Circuit decision. I got to adjudicate this claim the way I do. That's one thing, like granting relief at the end of a case in an ordinary claim. The preliminary injunction factors require the court to make a predictive judgment. And in addition to this court's opinions, Your Honor, there are also the orders from this court looking to, and we brought them to the district court's attention at the hearing, looking to the Supreme Court stay order. For example, in the 2808 litigation, the district court stayed its own injunction. And there was an appeal to this court asking it to lift the stay. And this court said, no, we're not going to lift the stay. And there was an injunction out of El Paso, but it also looked to the Supreme Court stay order. So when the district court heard this.
But Ms. Murphy, I thought that the reason that the district court didn't impose a stay on that 2808 part and that a court of appeals here didn't do that is because there are in large part that they didn't do that because there was a stay or there was an injunction already in place. Am I incorrect in that?
So that's absolutely true. But that again, in the 2808, Your Honor, at the time that this court, the time that this court refused to lift the stay, there was an injunction in place. But this is where I want you to look at the California part of the most recent 2808 opinion, where this court has, over and again said California, and particularly the published opinion in California in Sierra Club 2, where the court said when the district court did what it did and denied an injunction, California was protected by the Sierra Club injunction. It's not protected anymore, and we're still going to say that it wasn't an abuse of discretion for the district court to deny injunctive relief.
Just a minute. Can I ask you a question before I forget? You just said the court is not protected anymore, right? Did you say that?
At the time that this court affirmed the denial of the injunction to California, California was no longer protected by the Sierra Club injunction because the Supreme Court had stayed it. And at this point too, Your Honor, there's no injunction currently in place. And I think the district court also looked to that and said if I'm going to enter this injunction, it's exactly the same, more or less, as the one that the Supreme Court stayed.
Well, so all right. Let me ask you a related question. We have the merits decision now, right, from the Ninth Circuit in the Sierra Club case. I guess it's Sierra Club, but is it three, something like that?
The Section 2808 decision, yes.
Yes, now, and that's subsequent to the Supreme Court stay order, right?
Correct.
And it, I think, took some pains to distinguish the stay order. Now, at one point in your argument earlier, you said something like, I don't know if you're referring to this specific point or not, but you said something like, there's every reason to believe that the government will prevail in the Supreme Court, all right?
Yes.
Now, does that apply to this, I'll call it Sierra Club 3?
So, Your Honor, the government hasn't even filed its petition in that case. So, and it's a little bit different. That case is a little bit different. So I am not, obviously the government's position is that it's going to prevail. I'm not going to stand here and make, it doesn't have, the reason that I said that, Your Honor, was because when the Supreme Court granted the stay, it gave us a hint. Because as Judge Tolman pointed out, under the Maryland versus King standard, the government had to show that there was a fair prospect of reversal. and that there was a likelihood of irreparable harm to the government if the stay was denied. So we have more of an indication from the Supreme Court. In the 2808 case, the mandate's not going to issue until the government files it, until the date when the government has stated that it will be filing its petition for certiorari. So as of now, there's no injunction in force in that case either. But we're going to have to see how that case unfolds.
And the government's intention is to petition for cert in Sierra Club 3.
A petition has been authorized in Sierra Club 3, Your Honor. Okay. And we said as much to the court when we asked for the extension of the mandate.
Okay.
Ms. Murphy, and I'm not trying to be difficult. I'm just trying to.
Oh no! Please.
For myself, but you said that our Miller versus Gammy are my concern with, you know, intervening authority that's clearly irreconcilable. That this is different because this is a preliminary injunction. I think that's what you're saying. What can you give me your best authority for that?
I suppose my best authority would be all the cases that say it's within the discretion of the district court, that and the cases that hold that the plaintiff can make the showing on all of the elements and is still not entitled to an injunction. And also the plain legal fact that in the preliminary injunction context, the district court is being asked to guess. So as I say, it's not as though it's being asked to apply something other than circuit law. It's being asked to predict.
No, I know. Really... And I know that. And that's fair. But we have a merits decision now from our own circuit.
I understand that, Your Honor. But it's... But there was also the Supreme Court stay afterwards. And I think if you look at it from the district court's perspective, it has to read the tea leaves. And I understand Your Honor's concerns about circuit precedent and district courts having to follow it. Of course they do. But I think the court also had in front of it the examples of this court in border barrier litigation looking to that Supreme Court stay order in doing things like declining to lift the stay in the 2808 litigation before the merits decision. So I think if the court sees this court doing it, it's really hard to say that that's a legal error on the part of the district court, because it may not be following the merits decision, but it certainly is doing exactly what this court did in another case. And we did bring that ruling to the district court's attention at the hearing.
So as I understand your argument, you're saying because the district court has to make a predictive judgment about the significance of the stay orders, that is a permissible factor in determining the likelihood that the tribe will ultimately succeed on the merits?
Well, it has to consider all of the relevant factors, and it seems that relevant factors include, since the actual, it didn't just look at the opinions in the Sierra Club case, importantly, it looked also at the actual injunction, and the status of that injunction is stayed. So, you know, as we said in our brief, at a minimum, the court could have done what Judge Gilliam did in the 2808 litigation. It could have said, well, you know, I understand circuit precedent. I have to enter this injunction. But I also am aware of what's going on in the Supreme Court, so I'm going to stay it. That would have been completely legitimate, too. I think it's an area where district courts really do have significant discretion as long as they don't, you know, commit legal error or, you know.
I have one more question. Is it your position or the government's position that the fiscal year 2020 funding transfers at issue here were substantively different from the fiscal year 2019 funding transfers that the Sierra 2 Club panel held violated Section 8005?
No.
I guess, and specifically, is there any new evidence or change in circumstance or circumstances that would make the fiscal year 2020 transfers more clearly necessary in the national interest or more clearly as unforeseen military requirements than in fiscal year 2019?
No, Your Honor. In fact, it's notable. So for fiscal year 2020, even after living through the events of fiscal year 2019, including litigation, Congress gave the Department of the Defense the exact same transfer authority that it had given it in 2019. So that's a fairly significant indication that Congress did not want to, the statutory language is identical. But apart from that, it's like, I don't think there's any difference in the statutory authority. The language of Section 8005 is the same. As I say, we have Congress giving the Defense Department the same authority that it had in the previous year, knowing at that point that DOD had used that authority to fund counter-narcotics activity.
All right. Is there any other question, Judge Tashima, Judge Tallman, for Ms. Murphy?
No.
No.
Thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Yes.
All right. Mr. Gertler, we went well over time with Ms. Murphy, so I'll give you, I think we've gone over time with you too, but I'll give you about 8 minutes. Thank you.
So I'll address the likelihood of success issue first, and then I want to address some of the points about irreparable harm. But I think my opposing counsel is suggesting that the district court had some discretion in determining the law here. And of course, that's not the law. The district court is bound by the law of the circuit, and the circuit reviews the district court's decisions on the law de novo. The other cases that the government cites where the district court found likelihood of success on the merits and denied the injunction or stayed the injunction anyways, right, those were cases where they did find that the funding scheme was illegal, and that's not what happened here. And I think we said in our briefs, we're arguing about what the district court did, not what it didn't do. So the district court didn't find on the merits and then stay an injunction. It said there's no likelihood of success on the merits based on this cause of action issue, which this court has resolved in the Sierra Club in California.
But you do agree, do you not, that the district court has to make a predictive judgment as to what the ultimate likelihood of success will be on the merits, and then balance that against the showing of irreparable harm in deciding whether or not to grant injunctive relief?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's right. But the district court makes the analysis on each issue, and then at the end decides, given the way each issue came out, whether to issue the injunction or not. The error that we're pointing out here that the district court made was on the likelihood of success factor itself, not necessarily, I mean, we argue about the injunction too, but the district court made a clear error in its conclusion on the likelihood of success issue. I think whether to issue...
Is your position strengthened or weakened by the fact that the court has now granted certiorari on both California and Sierra Club 1 and 2?
Your Honor, I don't think it makes a difference here. I think the law is clear in this circuit that the only thing that changes a binding panel decision is a Supreme Court decision or an en banc decision from the circuit. And neither.
Well, that's true. That's true with regard to settled law. But again, I'm back to my question about predictive judgments here. The question is, what is the likelihood of ultimate success on the merits? And it seems to me that is a factor that the court can and should consider, is it not, in trying to make that prediction?
I think it is, Your Honor, but I think the analysis is about likelihood of predicting likelihood of success under existing law, not under law as it might change. And at the time of the district court's decision, Sierra Club 2 and California versus Trump had succeeded the Supreme Court stay order. They came after the Supreme Court stay order, and that's what bound the district court. I'd like to move to the irreparable harm issue, unless there are any questions on it.
Yeah, can I ask you a question on that? Because I did ask Ms. Murphy about that in terms of why isn't this more like Sierra Club 2 or Alliance for the Wild Rockies in terms of the harm, you know, aesthetic, you know, the enjoyment of the land. And she responded that it was never pled. And do you think you pled it? And if so, can you show me where you pled that?
Your Honor, I don't have the complaint in front of me, but and Ms. Murphy is correct when she said that the focus of the complaint were on legal issues like RFRA and Section 201 and other things that required this burial site issue, and that's what we focused on, of course. But there are other areas in the declaration, and I've cited one of them. I can cite a couple more where the tribe lays out this broader environmental harm. I cited the chairwoman's declaration. I cited evidence about sacred trails. I'd like to cite some evidence.
Did you put it in the complaint?
Your Honor, I'd have to look at the complaint again. I haven't looked at it in preparing for this hearing. I didn't think it was relevant, but I can look at it and follow up with some citations. But I believe we did plead in the complaint about the sacred character of the land and the irreparable harm that the project is causing to the sacred character of the land and the tribe's ability to practice its religion there.
Counsel, you're not challenging the existence of the waiver authority under IRERA Section 102, are you?
Not directly, but to the extent that Section 8005 authority, to the extent the government didn't have funding authority to fund the project, then it also didn't have authority to waive existing laws for the project.
But you're not challenging the authority itself to, in essence, suspend the various statutes, including the environmental statutes, that you're seeking to claim injury under.
No, we haven't. In our papers, we haven't challenged that.
All right. Okay.
So I am looking at the complaint now, and we do talk about in our violation of the Fifth Amendment cause of action, we talk about the harm from in the liberty interest of the tribe's ability to raise its children in the tradition, in the religion, and that this harm or this will be harmed by the project construction interfering with cultural sites and so on. I think that's part of the broader harm. Of course, you know, what irreparable harm wasn't a cause of action. Irreparable harm is an injunction factor. I want to respond to a few of the points that Ms. Murphy made. One statement she said is no burial sites were found in the project area. And I just want to emphasize again that statement is nowhere in the government's evidence. And I want to highlight something in particular on page 153 of the record. At the top of the page, Border Patrol's Paul Enriquez says, there has been no instance where the discovery of a significant cultural site or burial ground has required that construction be stopped to preserve or protect such sites. Now, this is one of the few statements about whether there was a finding or not. And here, of course, he qualifies it by significant. But again, significant to whom? I think in the tribe's perspective, the discovery of any ancestral remain is significant, and harm to it is irreparable to the tribe. So again, there's nowhere in the record where the government flat out says no burial sites or other cultural resources were found during construction. Ms. Murphy cites a case where...
Well, I thought the survey said no known sites. Isn't that saying the same thing? I mean, are we just arguing over grammar?
I think it's more than arguing over grammar, because known sites in my mind means recorded sites, and a field survey's purpose is not to find recorded sites. Recorded sites are in the archaeological records database. The point of the survey is to find unrecorded sites, and the tribe sites in its says in its declaration that those are what it's concerned about here is the unrecorded sites that the tribe has knowledge exists based on its oral tradition and in records from other archaeological sites.
You know, you have to excuse me, but your argument, you know, sort of reminds me of, remember Don Rumsfeld's comment about sometimes you know what you don't know, but sometimes you don't know what you don't know. And what you're talking about is, you know what you don't know, right? And in other words, that the district court should have given a greater account of unknown sites on what basis? Because you might dig up an unknown site?
No, Your Honor, because you're likely to dig up.
What do you mean by likely? Well, what degree of likelihood? What evidence supports that, it's likely?
As I said, 5 of the tribe's declarants attested to the likelihood based on their personal knowledge of the tribe's history. And the archaeologist Richard Carrico looked at nearby sites that have been surveyed, acknowledging that there haven't been comprehensive surveys in the project area, and findings of burials in those sites suggest there will be findings of burials in this site. That's what I mean by likely. And the district court, again, didn't say, based on the tribe's evidence alone, there's no likelihood. It looked specifically at this survey, which is what I'm taking issue with. The other point I wanted to make is that Ms. Murphy said in cases where the government found remains, they rerouted a road and they changed the position of a well. I'm not so sure they would do that in the case of the wall, and they haven't, right? In the record, there's an account where the tribe found what it identified as a bone and what a Mexican archaeologist identified as the bone 50 feet from the wall. The tribe thinks in that case there should have been some more survey work done and maybe the project rerouted, but it wasn't. The other thing I want to say about mitigation is the monitors on the project that Ms. Murphy referred to.
Was that the bone that nobody could find when they went back to look for it?
No, that was the other one. The bone that nobody could find, quote unquote, is the bone that our declarant Tom Holm discovered on the U.S. side of the border. And he says he found a bone on one account, a PVC pipe on another account. The bone he reburied, and the government came back and saw the PVC pipe and said, that's PVC pipe. The other bone I'm talking
about. So they couldn't find the bone?
Not in that case. In the other case, there was a finding of a bone 50 feet from the wall, confirmed.
On the Mexican side.
On the Mexican side, which 50 feet from the wall, this was Cogstone's report, the government's expert report, 50 feet from the wall. So I don't think that which nation it was found in says anything about whether there are more remains under the project area. The government brought that up to say their people could go out and investigate. The other point I wanted to make was about tribal monitors, and that doesn't give the tribe much comfort either, because we're talking about an 18-mile stretch of project here in the San Diego project, and there are 4 monitors there across 18 miles, 0 monitors in the El Centro project. The fact that the chance that a monitor will discover something and trigger the protocol to stop the project, I think, is almost impossible here in all cases.
I thought the district court said that you were offered the opportunity to supply your own tribal monitors, but the tribe declined if you wanted more monitors.
I don't think that's the case. The government may have alleged that in their declarations, but that's not the case. And besides the point, because it's not about.
Well, I thought it was an expense issue, because these folks are not cheap. We're paying them $75 an hour for their services.
Well, let's remember this is a $3 billion project. The government also said they couldn't, that cadaver dogs would be cost prohibitive. That's something that, is a little bit uncomfortable for the tribe considering the expense of the project. So, the government has an obligation, particularly where...
Well, the tribe's position is the government has to pay for everything, right? That's what we're talking about.
I'm not going to respond to that point, Your Honor. I don't think that's what the tribe's saying here. I think the tribe's saying that the government has unlawfully funded their project. The tribe has pointed out that there are burials within the project footprint, and that's harmful to the tribe, and that's enough for an injunction. The last point I want to make here is that the district court's findings on the other factors on public interest and likelihood of success, which we think were clear legal errors, clouded its analysis on the irreparable harm issue. And um, that that deserves remand, because at the very least, it's the minimum we're asking for. And I'll cite particular language from the district court. This is on page 4 of the record, where the court says, driving this court's determination today to deny an injunction is the fundamental legal principle that obligates lower courts to follow the orders of higher courts when making a ruling on a similar case with similar issues. So it's referring to its likelihood of success analysis, but that's what it's saying drove its determination about the injunction. Since its analysis was in legal error there, then I think its conclusion needs to be undone. It needs to be remanded back for reconsideration.
All right. Does anybody have any other questions?
I do not.
Okay.
Thank you both.
Thank you both, yes. Derek. I very much appreciate the oral argument presentation that were made today and to help us with this challenging case. The case of La Posta Band of Degueño Mission Indians of the La Posta Reservation versus Donald J. Trump is submitted. Again, thank you very much. We appreciate it.
This court for this session stands adjourned.